Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is an Irish author who's published 10 novels for adults and 5 for children. His work, Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, was turned into a film. The book sold more than 9 million copies worldwide and was a New York Times number one bestseller. He's won many, many international literary awards. John Boyne, thanks so much for coming on Meet the Writers.
Good to be here.
Were you always destined to be a writer? I mean, I see that that's what you did at college. Was it always in your mind?
Yeah, it was from childhood. It was certainly always what I wanted to be. Whether I would be good enough, I wasn't sure. But certainly from the age of about 8 or 9 years old, I was writing pretty constantly, taking characters from books I was reading and writing new stories for them. And as a teenager, I started sending stories out to magazines and newspapers, trying to get some published. And I started taking it very seriously, hoping that the day would come when I would be able to write a novel.
And then you went off to study it. Is it something one can be taught?
The thing about a creative writing course is it's not so much a place where you're taught how to write. It's more of a forum where a group of aspiring writers can come together, share their work, and you learn so much from reading other people's work and talking about it in class. Sometimes, you know, people criticise those kind of courses, but no one ever criticises people going to art school or film school. But writing school, for some reason, is criticised. But I found it, I mean, I was very young when I did it. I was only 22. So it was quite an emotional experience in many ways. But in the long run, I think it was very, very useful to me.
Now, we're going to talk about your latest book in some detail in a moment, The Heart's Invisible Furies. But what it does is take a look back at Ireland over the last 70 years. And I just wonder how, in your own life, from your childhood, you've seen the country change and what it was like for you as a boy growing up.
Well, I think it's changed mostly in the last 25 years more than anything else, because with this book particularly, you know, the central character, Cyril, is gay. And when I was in Trinity College in Dublin in the early 90s, homosexuality was still a criminal offence. So that was only decriminalised in the early 90s. And within 25 years, we became the first country to vote by public plebiscite for equal rights marriage. So it's changed a lot over the last 25 years, mostly, I think, because of the child abuse scandals in the church. And the fact that the church lost its control over the government, over the people, and we became a less conservative, less Catholic country during that time. But I think in the years, the novel starts in 1945, immediately after the Second World War. I think between then and the 90s, the country was actually it didn't change at all, I think. I think it was a very old-fashioned conservative country.
Because, I mean, you had personal experience of this, didn't you? I mean, abused, beaten by, I think, a Carmelite, in fact, and also, of course, your own homosexuality.
Yeah, I mean, school was a hard place for many boys of my age group, I think, especially in those religious schools. Beatings and abuse was taken almost for granted a lot of the time. We all knew what was going on. We all knew who was happening to and who was doing it. And it sounds crazy now, but it seemed like just a normal part of life at the time. And I think kids today would find it very hard to understand that. But in those days, it just seemed like there was nothing you could do about it. You know, the church had such control and the priests had such control. So it just seemed like it seemed normal. And only after school, really, only when I got to college and even subsequent to that, did I start to feel very angry about those things and have certain emotional problems because of it, which I had to come to terms with in my own time, and which I think I did. They were difficult days, certainly.
What about your relationship with your parents? Did they know what was going on?
My relationship with my parents has always been very good, but no, not so much. I mean, maybe a little bit about the beatings, you know, but there was always this attitude, not just with my parents, but with everybody's, that if you got it, you probably did something to deserve it, you know. And perhaps I did, I don't know. But I think they wouldn't have known, or anybody's parents wouldn't have known quite how to deal with anything else that was going on. It just would have been outside of their realm of experience.
And what about your sexuality? How did your parents react to that? Did they know?
Well, I mean, I told them when I was about 21, 22, something like that. And I don't think they fell off the seat in astonishment, particularly. But, you know, there was a lot of Jason Donovan posters on my wall when I was growing up. But they were fine, actually. They were very supportive. Of course, they worried, you know, that what would the future hold? And, you know, we're all aware that there is prejudice out there and life is hard enough without having one extra thing to make life harder. But they were actually very, very supportive and non-judgmental about it.
Of course, this is the first time that you've really written about this in any kind of detail. That this book seems to be a change of direction for you. And I wondered if we could go back to your first published works, because you were working in a bookshop. You left college. You in fact, were at Trinity, and then you went to UAE, where you won the Curtis Brown Prize, which is always, I think, a great indicator of somebody who's going to turn into a fantastic novelist. But from there, onto a bookshop, not immediately a fully blossoming literary career.
No, it took a few years. I spent 7 years working in a bookshop in Dublin, well, six of them in Dublin and one of them in London. It just seemed like the right place for me to be at the time. I was in my 20s. The shop was full of aspiring writers, musicians, actors, actresses. It was a very creative place for 20-somethings and to be around books all the time. We had a great events program in the shop, so we always had writers coming in, editors, publicists, and so on. It was really terrific. And I was working on a novel at the time, you know, and wrote one, got an agent, didn't get it published, then wrote another one and did. So it was, I got my deal when I was 28 and I was published when I was 29. And at the time, I thought I was 100 years old and that the world was passing me by. Now, I look back now and I think, oh, you know, you're just a child. But at the time, it seemed, I guess because of my group at UEA, four people got published and I was the last one. And the other three had got published almost immediately after UEA. And then there'd been a couple of a year's gap. And I wondered, you know, was it all over for our year?
So that first book was The Thief of Time.
That's right, Jess.
Were you surprised by how it was received?
No, because, it was received pretty well. It got decent reviews, but it didn't sell very well. It's very hard for, you know, a debut novelist to break through. And those first couple of books, I was pleased with the reception they got. But I was hoping that they would sell a few more copies and bring a few more readers in.
Was there a bit of a hiatus after that book and the Congress of Rough Riders?
More after that one, I think, between that and Crippen, because I was the editor I was working with in the publishing house had left, so I was out of contract. The publishing house didn't want to continue with me anymore. I think they felt I was over before I'd begun. So yeah, there was a couple of years then, I think it was 3 years between Congress of Rough Riders and Crippen, my third novel. But it was difficult because I also felt, God, you know, it's my career completely finished at the age of 31. But I've always been quite a hard worker. I've always been very disciplined and focused on what I'm doing. And I felt it would come good, you know, one day. I always say to students now, to aspiring writers, that it's very difficult to get a first novel published, but it's even more difficult to get a fourth or a fifth or a sixth novel published. To be given that freedom to have some books at the start of your career that, don't sell as well as they might have hoped and where you're trying to build that career, it's rare these days.
So was there a moment when you thought, this is it, I am a proper writer. I can stop selling books and just write them?
Well, I stopped after the second book, even though I'd been dropped. I felt that if I didn't focus full time on writing, then it wasn't going to work out in the long term. So I couldn't really afford to leave the shop, but I did. And I moved down to Wexford on the south coast of Ireland, where it was going to be cheaper to live. And I had some savings and I thought, right, you know, I'll focus now on this and write this book, hoping it would come together. And sure enough, it did.
And that was Crippen.
That was Crippen, yes. Mm.
So all of your books, it would seem, have some strong historical element in it. Why is that? Has history always been a big thing for you?
Up until sort of the last maybe three years or so, up until The History of Loneliness, the novel preceding The Heart's Invisible Furies, history was very much part of what I was writing about. And I've always enjoyed history. I've always enjoyed historical novels. I like the research that's involved. I like the travel that's involved with some of them. I like recreating parts of history that have always fascinated me, like the First World War, like the Russian Revolution. You know, I've written about them, the Second World War, of course, I've written about. I like finding interesting parts of history and building a story around them. Yeah, for a long time, that's pretty much what I did. And it's only in the last 4 years or so that I've stopped doing that, at least for now, and started writing about Ireland, because the last two books now have been about Ireland and been, you know, reasonably contemporary, even though they go, like this novel goes over 70 years, as you said, but I would consider it a contemporary book in its way.
So why didn't you write about Ireland for so long?
I think it was because I felt I didn't have a story to tell. You know, my imagination was taking me elsewhere. That's what I always said about that. Now, I wonder now whether I just felt that I didn't have the confidence to do so, to write about something so personal. These two novels set in Ireland are the most personal novels I've written. And I wonder now whether when I was like 33, 34, whether I felt not ready to put so much of myself into the story, into the text, that I wanted to kind of keep a distance between myself as a writer and the novels that I was writing. So, you know, I'm proud of the novels I wrote before, which are not personal as such, but I avoided it for a long time. And I did wonder whether I would ever write about Ireland. I wasn't going to beat myself up over it either. You know, I don't think that just because you come from a particular country that you have to write about that country. I think you should always just write the story that is most interesting to you at the time.
Even though it's not your voice per se, it's your voice. And I know that authenticity is something that really matters to you.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I've done so much research for all these different books in different ways. And you need to make the voice authentic. You need to make the time feel authentic. You need to know as much about your subject as you can as a writer, and then make the decisions about what you're going to be absolutely accurate about and what you can play with a little bit. You know, it's still a fiction, and your first duty is still to the story that you're serving. But all the books, at least I think the last 7 or 8 books I've written for adults, have all had first-person narrators, whereas all the books I've written for young people have third-person. So there is something about that authentic adult voice dipping as deeply into the psychology of a character that is very important to me in these books.
When you're writing historical fiction, are you led by the imagination or by fact?
By the imagination, increasingly. In the early days, probably more by fact. And as time has gone on, I've found myself less enslaved by the rigors of facts. You know, I think as long as you know what you're changing and why you're changing it, and it doesn't make the novel too anachronistic. You know, I wouldn't have the Russian Tsar flying in on a jumbo jet, but I would put him in a place he wasn't at a time he wasn't. Yeah. I think if you want the absolute facts, then turn to nonfiction. Once you've put a created character into this world, it's corrupted anyway. So I've never felt that concerned about that. The thing is, once you write a historical novel, there are people who are always going to go through it looking for what they consider to be wrong on all the mistakes. And I don't think there are mistakes in fiction. I think there's good fiction and bad fiction and good writing and bad writing. But I don't think there are mistakes in there.
And that whole problem of how much of your research to reveal and how much the audience needs to know. I mean, you don't have Jane Austen, for instance, saying a carriage, which is a vehicle pulled by 4 horses. You've got to assume some knowledge, haven't you?
Yeah, and I think that comes with experience as a writer, that you know how to structure chapters and how to structure paragraphs so that you are putting all that information in without it feeling like, you know, you're cribbing off the rough guide to St. Petersburg or something. You know, that it should appear in the text seamlessly. And that's what rewriting is for. That's what every subsequent draft is for. I read my books aloud each day when I've written the scene. I read it aloud to hear, is there something which jars? Is there something which sounds exactly like that it sounds like it's just come from a history book.
So tell me more about this divide between third person and first person, and if that was a deliberate thing to distance your young adult novels from your adult.
It wasn't deliberate. It's something that I only actually realised a couple of years ago. But when I realised it, it made sense to me. When it comes to the young people's books, I always feel that I can't put myself in the voice of an 8 or 9-year-old boy. Even though I once was an 8 or 9-year-old boy, I feel that I need to have a narrative voice which is somewhat distant from the story. And I always tell those stories as if the narrator has heard this somewhere and doesn't always know all the parts of the story, and the children have to fill in the blanks a little bit. But with the adult books, it has to be first person for me, following one person's life, one person's story. And as I said, getting as deep inside their psychology as possible. And oftentimes that character is lying to the reader. Unreliable narrators are, you know, an important thing in first-person narratives. And then they don't always know that they're lying. You're following them through all this time. And sometimes they're saying what they believe, but you, the reader, are one step ahead of them. Mm. So it's not something, as I said, that I planned out. It just seems to be the way that I work.
Just take me through the timeline of this. At what point when you were writing adult novels did you realise that, in fact, you could also be writing for young people? And how easy is it to just differentiate the two? Do you have your audience absolutely in mind?
When I finished my 4th novel, Next of Kin, that was when I wrote The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas. And when I wrote that, I did think then, OK, you know, this is a... I had never thought about writing for young people before or about young people before. And I did think, well, this could be an interesting second part of my career, you know, to write for young people. And since then, I've kind of moved back and forth between the two. So I'll write one for adults, then one for young people. And that's worked quite well for me in terms of my own creative imagination, in terms of the types of stories that I've been writing. But I'm quite surprised by it in a way. I had never, like 20 years ago, I had never imagined writing for young people. It wasn't part of my plan at all. But it's become something which is quite important to me. Mm. So in terms of planning the novels, though, yeah, it is kind of one for one and then one for the other. So I finish one and I generally feel, right, now I'm going to do a book for the opposite audience. The biggest change in that is actually right now, because I've just published this adult novel and I just felt I wanted to write a new adult novel immediately after this for whatever reason in my own head. So I'm taking a break from the kids for a couple of years now.
Of course, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas must have utterly changed your life. It was such an immediate, huge success.
Yeah, I mean, that was the turning point in both my career and my life, really. When that book came out in the start of 2006, everything really changed. Suddenly I had readers around the world, an international audience, publishers around the world. Finally, I had a book that people were reading and responding to, and it was on a very important subject matter. For a few years, my whole life was really built around that book in terms of traveling to other countries to promote the book and then the film and so on. It was a really extraordinary sort of 3 or 4 years.
Are you happy with the film?
Yeah, I am. I think Mark Herman, who wrote and directed it, I think he did a very faithful adaptation. I think it's a very strong adaptation of the book. I was very pleased with it. Mm.
Of course, you don't have your own children. Is that something you regret?
Yeah, I mean, I would have liked to have had children, and I'm 45 now. And if I was sort of 30 now in 2017, I certainly would. I don't think there'd be any question in my mind. But I think I'm a bit, you know, long in the tooth at 45 now to go down the adoption road or whatever. I think it would just take so long, and you know, can't have everything.
But of course, as you say, you were an 8 or 9 year old boy, and yeah. You're writing from that experience of having been. You don't have to have.
Yeah, that's true. But sometimes, though, it's more difficult than in the adult novels. You know, I had never been a First World War soldier. I've never been a bodyguard to the Tsar. I've never been a governess in a 19th century house. And somehow they're easier sometimes to just completely make it up and to try to imagine what it was like to be that than it is to write as a child or for a child.
How much do you think your books are influenced by your state of mind at the time? I know that you've had some depression in the past.
I don't think the books generally are, because the books are generally the thing that make me happiest. You know, when I'm engaged on a novel, when I'm writing a draft, when I'm coming down to my desk every morning and excited about it, that's really when I feel best about myself, about life. It's one of the reasons why I try to write every day, 7 days a week, every day of the year. It's been the one constant, really, for me since my teenage days. Not just writing, but reading. That's always been the thing that's made me happiest.
Oh, let's talk about reading, because I know that you're a huge fan of John Irving, as am I. Tell me about the great man.
From the age of about 15 or 16, I completely fell in love with John Irving's books. And they made such a huge impression on me. And they were the first really adult contemporary books that did. And when I published my first novel, The Thief of Time, in 2000, I sent a copy of the novel with a letter, a fan letter, to John, and explained how he had influenced me and, you know, hero, all that. And he very kindly wrote back and he read the novel and we struck up a friendship. And that was 17 years ago. And he's been a real kind of mentor to me over the years. And we've met many times and I'd consider him a very good friend now. And I actually dedicated this new novel to him, which I don't think I've ever dedicated a novel to anybody outside of my family. This is the first time, but really to kind of recognize how important he's been to me as a reader and as a writer, but also because this particular book, which deals with sexuality so much, and John Irving has spent so much of his career writing about what he calls sexual misfits, and that's a term that I don't use in my book, but it's something which would apply very well, I think.
Yeah, is it time you put someone in a bear costume in your books?
I don't think I'd get away with that. I think I've got as close to Irving territory in this as I possibly could without him suing me. So.
What about McEwan? Because part of this book, your new book, The Heart's Invisible Furies, is narrated by a fetus in the womb, as we see in Nutshell.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I guess we were both writing that around the same time, though, because Ian McEwan's novel came out, about last September or something. And this has just come out. And it's only the opening chapter of this book is narrated by Cyril while he's still in the womb. So I don't think either of us were aware of the other one doing that.
Mm. I'm also interested in the way that you portray female characters, women in your books. I know that in the past that you were criticised slightly for misogyny and things like that, and that you're very firm on trying to make very strong female characters.
I am, yeah. And from, I think it was my seventh or eighth book, The House of Special Purpose, I made a deliberate decision that I wanted to write much stronger female characters in my books. And including in that is the novel This House is Haunted, which is narrated by a female character. And it has become something that's really important to me. In the opening section of this book, a 16-year-old girl, Cyril's mother, Catherine, is banished from her hometown in West Cork for being pregnant and unmarried, and off she goes to Dublin. But I never wanted to make her a victim. I wanted to make her really strong and funny and brave. Most of the women in my most recent books tend to be the sensible ones, and the men tend to be daft half the time or incompetent or complicit in terrible crimes. It's the women who generally are the strongest ones. I remember, like, when I was accused at some point in some book of misogyny, and it just appalled me because I think I would be the last person in the world who would be that. So yeah, maybe it's just because of that that I just really try to write very strong female characters.
Mm. Because the male characters, as you say, are sometimes quite soft, quite tender. I wonder why you think that masculinity or macho culture stop men talking about their feelings. For instance, depression and anxiety, you're very open about yours, but generally men aren't.
I think in my generation and with younger people now, I think men are better at that. I think we're much more open about talking about personal things and not quite so competitive with each other. A lot of the time people didn't talk about those things because men wanted to feel that they, you know, always strong, and they had to be stronger than their friends and had to be more successful and had to be richer and had to have a more beautiful wife and all of that sort of thing. And I don't think younger people now feel that way. Certainly when I look at my nephews, for example, they wouldn't be like that at all. They would be very open with their feelings. They would talk to their friends about their emotions and in a way that I never would have when I was 19 or 20. So I think those kind of things have changed for the better.
Of course, another thing that's changed, which we touched on briefly near the beginning, is the church in Ireland. In your A History of Loneliness, you talk about confronting your prejudices, taking a middle path, if you like, showing loyal churchgoers, recognising, though, that the church isn't innocent in its crime. And I wondered why, when you clearly have strong feelings about Catholicism, you chose to take that very pragmatic view, I suppose.
Oh, it was very important that I did, because if I had gone the other direction, or if I had written the book 10 years earlier, it would have been full of anger and rage, and just, it would have been a diatribe against the church, and it wouldn't have been interesting. It wouldn't have been a work of literature at all. It would have just been boring, I think. Mm. You know, you can't have 400 pages of somebody screaming at you. So what I was interested in when I wrote that book was the idea of what is it like to be an elderly priest who has committed no crimes, but who, because of the actions of many of the other people in the clergy, is kind of basically tarred with the same brush, you know, that if a child comes near and the parent will pull the child away. And I spoke to a lot of priests while I was writing that book and heard some kind of horror stories about the way that they are treated in public, people who have never actually committed a crime. So it was important for me to try to understand why the priests who had committed the crimes committed them, but also what it was like for those who didn't. And I don't plot out my novels in advance. I let them develop on the page before me. And I thought when I wrote that book that my central character, Father Odrin Yates, was going to be a very good, very decent man. But as it developed, I realised that even though he had committed no crimes, he was actually complicit in the crimes of others by being aware of things and turning away, doing nothing, saying nothing. And the great story there in Irish history over the last 50 years is that it's not so much the relatively small amount of priests who committed the crimes, it's the majority of priests who knew about them and who did nothing. And I would suggest that they are just as guilty.
Of course, the Catholic Church staunchly in favour of nuclear families and children from the same parents. Overall, they take a dim view, or at least did, of babies born out of wedlock and divorce and non-nuclear families. Which brings us onto this book, The Heart's Invisible Furies. Now, Cyril's born poor, out of wedlock. He's adopted by a middle-class couple. They make it very clear that he's not a real Avery. He's an outsider, if you like, in an exclusive world. I wondered about wanting to show the dynamic of Cyril not being real, about the idea of genetic authenticity or even purity being something you wanted to unpick.
From the start, I knew that Cyril was going to be an outsider, that he wasn't going to fit in really anywhere because he is not with his birth parents. He is confused about his sexuality. And then when he is no longer confused, he's terrified of it. So I wanted him to feel very alone and isolated from the start, because I knew that even though he's the hero of the story, that he would also commit some acts along the way that would not endear him to people, that he would make some pretty bad choices and mistakes, but that there'd be a reason for that. When I set up that scene when he's seven, when he's with his adoptive parents in that chapter, I wanted those parents to be quite distant towards him, but I didn't want them to be kind of Dickensian, nasty adoptive parents. They're just, they're eccentric. You know, they've adopted this boy, but they almost forget that he's a child. You know, they treat him like an adult. Mm. And most of the time, he is the only sensible person in the house and is looking after both of those parents. And I tried to make it funny there. You know, I wanted it to have a strong comic element because I didn't want it to be just a sad story about somebody who has gone through 70 years of an unhappy life. I wanted him to have... He's quite an optimistic character a lot of the time. And he's quite... He sort of just puts up with whatever is there. The idea of being an outsider was very important, I think, from the start.
The book has an absolutely heart-wrenching ending. I wonder, you say you don't plot them out in advance. Were you as traumatised by it as I?
No. I mean, I think the writer keeps a certain distance in that way. But even though I don't plot them, as you're writing it, it starts to take shape in the writer's head, I feel. It certainly does for me. I can see where it's going and I can. I don't actively try to think of what will happen next, but it will suggest itself. You know, I will suddenly see what will be the, like, a really clever place to bring the story and to bring the characters. And then the whole arc of the book takes shape before me. And that's a really exciting part of writing. I really like that when that happens, when it suddenly opens up. I sometimes feel like the novel is all there at the back of my head and I just have to dig away to find it for myself.
It's such a beautiful, beautiful book. John Boyne, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me about it.
Thank you.
John Boyne, The Heart's Invisible Furies came out in February. It's published by Doubleday. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of Claire Urban, Kieran Banerjee and Tom Furze. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.